Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to CSIS. I'm truly delighted to see so many of you here for what I think will be one of our most interesting discussions of the year. I would like to ask John Hamry, who's able to be with us only for a few minutes, to kick off. What I'm trying to do with this morning's session is to focus our minds on the nonproliferation issue and India in ways that I don't think have been done until now, and I think it's a missed opportunity. Dan, you came in just in time to find your nameplate, and I promise we will get you coffee.
Wonderful. Hey, Dan.
The debate so far has been over whether, why, etc., the rules of the nonproliferation game are changing. What I would like to focus on is, if you take the prevention of new entrants into the nuclear weapons club as the big problem of the day, how does India fit into that process? And since we're all focused on the India-US deal, how does that help India fit into that process if it goes through? What are the challenges that we all face? I'm going to turn the floor over to John briefly, and then I will come back and introduce the speakers.
Very briefly, and I will. And let me just say thank you to all of you for coming. I'm really grateful to have you here. Mike Gadbois, thanks for heading up our India Council. I'm really very pleased. You've been so helpful. You and Bill have just been stalwarts, and very, very grateful for that. Well, we all do, Bill Clark.
Yeah, and if you believe that, I've got some land I'd like to say.
But seriously, I'm really just delighted for what you guys have done to help us. Tom Pickering, it is always my joy to have you back here. I hope there's a lot more of you available for us now. You've been so darn busy these last years, but we're really delighted.
Thank you.
Really very grateful that you're here. I just did want to say that I think this emerging relationship between the United States and India is arguably the biggest strategic development of this decade, maybe of many more decades. Its implications are just astounding. And it really is a long overdue waking up from a period of enforced political amnesia. You know, we just had to, for a combination of reasons, the 60s and the 70s and the 80s led us to drift apart in ways that ultimately now we're trying to overcome, and it was not helpful. The most important thing, though, is it is not simply the development of a bilateral relationship now. It's really a global stakeholder partnership that's now being developed. That's what's really quite different. It's not strictly inviting warm ties between India and the United States. It's really much larger than that. And it's this which is why this question of NPT is so important. India, for its own good reasons, chose not to enter into the nonproliferation treaty, but one would say it's probably been one of the most responsible nuclear powers of the last 30 years. I mean, so it clearly has seen itself as a responsible citizen in the international stage on what is a very emblematic issue. So it isn't a case of simply a bilateral, U.S.-India relationship, even as strategic and as important as that is. It's absolutely huge. But it's much bigger than that, because we're really talking about two countries along with a set of others that are prepared to be, you know, the major stakeholders of what we hope is a better international order in the years ahead. And because the previous era was so dominated by the NPT in this dimension, was so dominated by the NPT, and it now is in serious question, and that's part of the debate that we're having, is that this sort of a forum becomes essential. If we're going to craft truly a global perspective for the future where India and the United States are global partners and stakeholders in this new regime, we better start working our way through this. And that's why I think it's such a crucial thing to do this. It's much bigger than U.S.-India, much bigger. And that's why we're so glad to have, you know, two of the most important idea leaders in India here today to lead this discussion. I hope we honor you with the quality of people that have been assembled, and you clearly have seen that these are... It's frightening, isn't it? I'm not qualified to participate. I'm only allowed to have the... I'm really, you know, kind of arm candy for a think tank. You know, I come here just to open things up. But this is... this really is a crucial thing, and I'm delighted that you're willing to lead it for us. So, Tezi, is Tezi still here? Tezi, okay, get in here and take over, you know, because I'm at the end of what I could possibly say. Thank you, everybody. Okay. I'll be back later. I'll open up another one.
Before we get started, I would note that there are 1, 2, 3, 4 seats at the table. There's no particular reason why they have to stay empty, particularly since there may be a few other stragglers coming in. Does somebody know how to turn off the computer until... This gets beyond my technological capabilities.
The projector will still be on, though, because we have to go there and turn it off.
Let me start by acknowledging, as John already has, this is kind of an expanded meeting of the CSIS Policy Council for India. And the co-chairs of that council are here with us today, Mike Gadbaugh and Bill Clark, my intellectual mentors in a lot of what we do here. I'm grateful to Ambassador Pickering for having joined us. And if I acknowledged all of the distinguished people in the room, we would still be here at lunchtime by the time I finished doing that. So I will refrain from that, say how grateful I am to all of you for being here and how much I look forward to all of your contributions to thinking about what I consider to be one of the important problems that we are facing in world politics and security. We do have a wonderful group of speakers who have come, in some cases, from all the way from India. What I'm going to do is introduce them one at a time. Each of them will make a presentation. I will then ask Dan Poneman to respond with whatever response he wants, plus some thoughts of his own. And we will then go to a Q&A/discussion format. So let me start with C. Rajamohan, who is sitting immediately to my left. Dr. Mohan is currently the strategic affairs editor for the Indian Express and is one of the established authorities on India's role in the international system. He has written what I consider to be the best book on India's contemporary foreign policy. He's also written a book on the India-U.S. relationship, which he whipped up in an astonishingly short time in the past few months. I have asked him, he's also taught at Jawaharlal Nehru University, so he's worked in both the journalistic and academic settings, and I believe, are you still a member of the National Security Advisory Board? Just about to finish. But so he's got all three, journalism, government, and academia, and I would like him to kind of set the stage for where this issue fits in the larger geostrategic scene as seen from Delhi.
Thank you. Thank you, Ambassador Schiffer. Thank you for inviting me for this, and to be among so many old friends and people who have dealt with on this nuclear issue over the years to the great benefit of India and the Indian political commentators and the political elite. Now, please, Indians don't know when to stop, so you do let me know when the time is up. So maybe I'll speak for about 15-odd minutes. I think the central element of this deal that the Bush administration has done with India, the principal justification for it and the description of it has been that India is unique, that this deal is about making an exception for India, and that this deal is about dealing with India's nuclear exceptionalism. And I think that is the the central element, and I think that's precisely why it is so controversial at this point of time. And to understand this, I think you've got to look back at two aspects. And I think one is the India's own attitude to nuclear weapons and how nuclear weapons and non-proliferation fitted into India's foreign policy is indeed an exceptional story. I'll try and bring some of that out in the next few minutes. And at the same time, you have the second aspect, which is the Bush administration, and before that, the Clinton administration, both tried in their own ways to come to terms with the fact that the world's largest democracy, a billion people, were outside the non-proliferation system, and that you had to find a way of squaring the circle. That the success of the Bush administration in what it achieved on July 18th, 2005, and March 2nd, 2006, could not have been done without the negotiation that went on during the Clinton years. Bob is right here, who was part of that negotiation, and that negotiation for 2 years was, in fact, the first ever nuclear security dialogue between India and the United States. And I think that provided a basis for understanding each other and what were the do's and don'ts the two sides could afford to do, could have to deal with, and that what happened in the second term of the Bush administration could not have been done without the groundwork that was done in a very significant manner. I see Ambassador Inderfoot is here as well. That and Ambassador Pickering, all of you were involved in the Clinton years in the negotiations with India, and I think that laid the foundation for a fresh look, and which is what we saw happen on the July 18th, 2005. Now, let me say a few words about India's exceptionalism in the past and then see where we can go once the agreement is carried through in the coming years. Looking at India's, the past approach of India to nuclear weapons and the role nuclear weapons played in its foreign policy, no other country had the kind of strange positions that India developed over the years. That here was, if you just look at the current debate in India, I think you have the strongest opponents to nuclear weapons, the left parties, are also opposed to signing the CTBT. The strongest supporters of nuclear weapons tend to be those today, in fact, those who initiated the process, the BJP, today, of course, is partly domestic politics, standing apart and throwing stones at this agreement, but essentially picking at the same arguments that the left uses on discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. I think we know the full dimensions of those. So the interesting part is that on the left, the strong appeal of the liberal left impulse, which focused on question of discrimination and also focused on disarmament, that India should actually work for universal disarmament and that India should not have anything to do with nuclear weapons. And on the right, you had a small section, which is relatively weak through the history, which said, look, we need to have nuclear weapons and that we must get it in whatever form. But that was never decisive enough till the late 1990s, and that it could not really prevail over the stronger view on the left liberal sections, which was disarmament and fighting against discrimination, and that India should not join any treaty, any arms control regime that discriminates between people. And to see the evolution of these, how these positions developed over the period of time, I'll just briefly mention four dates, 1944, 1944, 1964, 1974, and 1998, and then we'll come to 2005 very briefly. 1944, even before the Manhattan Project was known to the public, India began its atomic energy program by setting up the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, a private sector initiative to fund a scientist who came from the West, who knew something was brewing and who believed that nuclear energy was going to be important. And Nehru, of course, gave strong support to it. So between 1944 and 1964, the emphasis was on international cooperation, promoting peace and disarmament, and creating the capabilities for production of nuclear energy. The focus was completely on nuclear energy. 1964, the Chinese test produced a different debate in the country. How should India respond to the Chinese nuclear weapons? A small section said we should make the bombs. There was strong opposition to making the bomb. So therefore, the policy that came out of the debate in 1964 was keep the option open, pursue the energy path, and try and reach out to the major powers to see the security problems arising out of 64, the Chinese test, could be addressed. The consequence, of course, was disaster on all fronts. We didn't get the security guarantees. We went to the US, Russia, and Britain. And the decision on nuclear bomb was left open-ended. And we went to the United Nations to get a treaty preventing the proliferation of nuclear weapons, which later became the NPT, which turned against India's options. Therefore, what India initiated in 64 at the United Nations ends up as a measure that it could not join. So you had a new situation between 64 and 74, which was to say, option open, no signing the NPT, no arms control. And we offer disarmament. In 74, we do the tests, and classic Hindu, Indian waffling, we said, look, we did a test and said, call it the peaceful nuclear explosion. So none of the dilemmas inherent in the 64 development of China were resolved in the 74 to 98, in the mid-90s period, and it remained one of keeping the option open, trying to pursue nuclear power program, which came under increasing stress because of the sanctions that came in post-74, and the continued rhetoric on disarmament at the global and the United Nations level. This, of course, becomes unbearable by the mid-1990s, when you had to remix these positions. And finally, a section in the Indian establishment began to argue the opportunity costs of not testing nuclear weapons was so high. India was in any case being targeted and sanctioned. Therefore, it makes sense to actually test and get over with and then deal with the world on the trail basis. So 98 was a leap for India from its own cherished assumptions about the nature of the international system, the role of power in the world, and the role of nuclear weapons. So once the 98 decision took place, of course, you see some fundamental changes are taking place in India's approach to nuclear weapons, arms control, and non-proliferation. In many ways, you could say 98 was like the difference between AD and BC. That post-1998, where India began to deal with the reality that, look, after having acquired nuclear weapons, that India's traditional positions on arms control were no longer sustainable. That until 1998, whatever the rhetoric was, the public rhetoric on disarmament was, the fundamental diplomatic objective was to defend India's nuclear option from being captured by the non-proliferation system. Post-1998, the challenge was, how do we reduce the costs of what we had done, in terms of what the US had done, what Japan had done, a whole range of others did, and to find a way of being accommodated into the international system. So the objectives, India's objectives, fundamentally changed post-1998, and that what is the paradox is that if we had not done the tests, we would never be for arms control. That as long as you didn't test and call yourself a nuclear weapon power, the logic of defending the option meant criticizing every single arms control measure that was suggested at the global level, whether it's NPT down the line, every single arms control measure India tended to oppose because it had to defend its option. But post having done the tests and declared itself a nuclear weapon power, it opened up a number of possibilities for India of actually negotiating for the first time with the United States and the rest of the world that we can define a new basis on which India's interests can be defended and pursued, and that that we saw in the period post-1998, a number of changes took place. Essentially, I would list the endorsement of the NPT, for example. I mean, till 2000, India always sort of ran down. NPT was the most dirtiest three-letter word India could find, and demonizing the NPT was the habit of Foreign Office. But in 2000, for the first time at the NPT quinquennial review conference, India for the first time issued a statement endorsing the objectives of the NPT, and in fact claiming to be in compliance with the objectives of the NPT. Of course, Bob and all saw it at the time, I think, as a devious attempt by India to legitimate itself as a nuclear weapon state. But it was a huge shift in terms of how we thought about the world domestically to get our system to say NPT is not a bad thing and that we must support it. The second change that took place was on supporting nuclear-free zones. India in the past found that nuclear-free zone was an attempt at capturing India's option in South Asia. And from that, India moves to saying nuclear weapon-free zones are good. India is prepared to support them in Southeast Asia, Africa, wherever the regions were willing to do it. A third set of changes was on export control. Though India always claimed that it had a great policy of responsible policy of not exporting to other nuclear states, it would not commit itself to a legal structure of cooperation where you abide by a set of international standards on export controls. So post-1998, that too saw a change in the negotiations in the Clinton administration. India began to upgrade its own non-proliferation export controls and begin to support it as a national objective. A fourth set of changes that took place after the 1998 tests was the, in the past, pre-1998, that is BC, India would reject any nuclear CBMs with Pakistan. One, because America was telling us to do it. The other, because we thought there's nothing. All you needed was to do disarmament. And Pakistan was, in any case, was a bad egg. From that, the idea that, look, having stability, regional stability, is in our interest. Therefore, it is necessary to engage Pakistan and the reality of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and come up with a set of nuclear CBMs. Became a national policy, and you saw that begin to happen. 1998 May were the tests. By 1999 February, when Vajpayee went to Lahore, we had initiated the first significant attempt at negotiating nuclear CBMs with Pakistan. So both in terms of, and within all this, as we did this, of course, we started downplaying disarmament as a big objective. That though today, if you ask the Foreign Office, they'll tell you, of course, we are for disarmament. But the emphasis in the past was absolutely saying, as if we said disarmament and, you know, we were taken care of. We didn't have to say anything else to the world, that India was for disarmament, therefore we are good guys. From that, I think we moved to actually beginning to recognize the value of arms control all across the board, both in the region, at the level of export controls, and at the level of accepting restraints on India's own nuclear program. Because the benchmarks that the CTBT, FMCT benchmarks that we agreed to negotiate with the Clinton administration for the acceptance for the first time of restraints on India's nuclear capability. For a new nuclear power, of course, this was, some people in India have criticized this as too eager to accept restraint. But the fact was, India recognized that if you had to be part of the system, you needed to accept some restraints on our own nuclear program, and I think that's again was a huge leap. So while these historic changes took place in the period 1998 to 2000, our hopes that by making these modifications in our policies, the Clinton administration would be prepared to reward or, you know, reciprocate with an agenda for nuclear energy cooperation. I mean, that was the hidden goal. I mean, I think it's quite clear, those of you who've seen Strobe Talbert's book, that our attempt was to change the American laws and find a way of actually getting to that the prohibited nuclear energy cooperation being revived. That, of course, proved impossible, both in terms of how the negotiations concluded and a whole range of other problems. I don't want to go into those details. But once the Bush administration came in, they said, look, let's find a way out of this and let's look at how we can take this further. The NSSP, the new Next Steps in Strategic Partnership, that was announced in 2004, January, was about finding ways within the existing legal framework to begin some cooperation between India and the United States. I mean, it was limited progress, but clearly a departure from the previous agenda of not entertaining any notion of cooperation with India. And on July, on the second term of the Bush administration, of course, we moved to the next stage of actually saying the U.S. can now take the initiative to change its laws, change the international rules to get India into the global nuclear non-proliferation order. So that is a leap. And in this process, and I think in getting that agreement on July 18th, India gave a series of commitments, a whole paragraph full of them. We don't have to go into the details. But many of the things that India had said, told to the Clinton administration then in different formats were fully identified in the July 18th. A series of commitments, CTBT, voluntary test moratorium, support FMCT negotiations, et cetera, et cetera. And that this deal, I think in that sense, got India for the first time to lay down a full range of commitments, both constraining its own program as well as working with the United States for strengthening a global nuclear order. Now, assuming this deal goes through, where is the future? I mean, where do we go from here? And there I would say my sense is once this deal is done, I mean, that you would see India far more willing partner in getting and working with the United States on a different non-proliferation agenda for the world. That there is no doubt that given the circumstances we are in, that it is not merely defending NPT as a treaty, but what we need is to defend a non-proliferation regime. And there, I think, India is prepared to fully cooperate in building a new order. And I think we believe that it's in India's own interest to do that, and I see that happening a lot more. The problem at this stage in terms of the domestic debate, because many in this room would say India should sign up to the PSI now or do a whole range of other things, the sense in India is that, look, while the ratings for America and Bush have dramatically gone up in India, perhaps the highest in the world these days, but we still, the establishment is saying, look, we've given enough, now let's see what the U.S. Congress does. Now, till we see progress here, there are the residual skepticism in India that, look, we've given something, we've given a separation plan, we've given a number of commitments, and that we haven't seen actually any movement so far. Hopefully next week we will see some. And that once we see that momentum happening here, then I think the sense of being more relaxed about the U.S. is actually committed to moving this forward would, I think, create a completely different situation. And once this deal is through, hopefully through the summer, then I think we're going to see an India that's going to work with the United States on a full range of issues, whether it's interdiction regimes, PSI, or constructing a whole new order. And I think the central basis for that is that so long as India was outside, you know, was it Lyndon Johnson who said it? I mean, outside the tent, pissing in. Now, if we sense that we are brought into the tent, it's going to be easier to be part, you know, our objective, I think, has always been to be part of the system rather than being outside. But having been left outside for so long, and the habit of, constantly criticizing, demonizing the non-proliferation system, we've seen changes taking place in that last few years. And once the deal is through, I would think India would be fully ready to be a constructive partner in the future in defining a new regime for the world. There, I think for the first time, the central change that has taken place is the recognition that non-proliferation is in our interest. It is not a mantra traditionally our Brahmins have told us, I mean, that you keep repeating the same thing irrespective of the circumstances. And I think we've moved from that, and today we see non-proliferation as a core interest of India, whether it is in preventing additional states from acquiring nuclear weapons in our neighborhood or in putting some kind of constraints on the Chinese and their proliferation behavior in our region, and whether it is the question of preventing the linkage between terrorists and WMD. All these, from our own experience, not because the U.S. is telling us, I think that's the difference we believe are central threats to India's security, and therefore India is prepared to act on them in cooperation with the U.S. But the first step is we got to get into the tent first. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Raja. As usual, you've started us off with a lot to think about. And let me now introduce Admiral Raja Menon, who, after a distinguished career in the Indian Navy, has become, in my view, one of the foremost thinkers about Indian strategic interests and, more generally, about how the strategic interests of India, the United States, and other countries come together, particularly in India's region, but more generally around the world. I've asked him to talk about what the focus of this kind of an active nonproliferation policy might be and where it fits in the international system. Are we talking about son of NPT, or are we talking about different things which exist outside of, next to, et cetera, the NPT structure? So, Admiral Menon, over to you.
Thank you, Tessie. I think this is a great privilege and an honor because it's a formidable audience in front of me. I remember being here about a year ago working on the Indo-US nuclear deal and presenting it as having a whole lot of advantages in Washington. And I remember that at the end there were some criticisms. What brings to mind is that the nature and tenor of the criticisms then are not the criticisms today. They have undergone a radical change. In those days, most people were taken aback at the speed of the deal. And the criticisms were confined to the fact that India might somehow technologically escape through gaps in the deal. Today, the nature of the criticism has changed completely. And I have looked at the writings of the most respected India hands because I think they have a certain sympathy for India. They have all written that although they are criticizing the deal, they are for closer Indo-US relationships. They are for the emergence of India as a as an emerging power, and that India needs to be assisted in that in that step. And assisting India with nuclear energy would be a good thing. They concede all that. But they still criticize the deal, and therefore I think we have to take these criticisms seriously, because it's my impression, I may be wrong, that they are the kind of people whom Congress might listen to. I've taken the criticisms as falling into three heads. One of them is that they say that non-proliferation will be weakened if we give India this deal. The second criticism is that the legal and the legal standing of the NPT will be weakened by the deal. And the third is that the U.S. interests will not necessarily be furthered, nor China diverted by helping India, because India is going to follow an independent foreign policy anyway. So I'd just like to take these three criticisms today. I think after the Cold War, particularly after the first Iraq War, the deterrence theory was gone, and people felt that what they should really worry about is the access that non-state actors will get to nuclear devices. And these anxieties were broadly three. The first was that would terrorists have the motivation, capability, and the resources to make or get access to a nuclear device? The second was that if terrorists didn't have all these three, could the gap be filled in by states? In other words, could states be reliably decoupled from non-state actors? And most countries have now accepted the fact that they need to get into the same kind of strategy as the United States, as counter-proliferation. And you see the Indian nuclear doctrine move in that direction by threatening nuclear retaliation for WMD attack on India. The last, of course, is would non-state actors get access to radiological devices? Let's deal with that first, as part of non-proliferation. I think India for the last 7 or 8 years has been in the forefront with the IAEA in locating, accounting for, and storing lost radiological devices. It is a regional center already in helping the IAEA to train countries, scientists and border management staff from other countries. It's cooperated with the NNRA of the United States. And India was the lead country in locating the orphaned radiological devices in Georgia after the Soviets withdrew. So India is already seriously into non-proliferation with the IAEA. But when we look at the non-state actors, I'm not fully convinced that I don't know what the technological level of the terrorists facing the United States is, but certainly in my part of the country, it's very difficult to say that the terrorists have access, have these three factors which I mentioned earlier. They're still some years away. But on the other hand, the attempted breakout by states, we have serious examples of that, and we have four of them. That's Libya, Iran, North Korea, and Pakistan. Each different in a different way, and unique. But of these, I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes on the Libyan case, because I think Libya is a classic case. It's a classic case of a state which acceded to the NPT and clandestinely tried to break out of it. Iran was probably a case that started like that, but it's not a case like that today. I mean, they are really sticking their case to the Article 4 of the NPT as it stands today. North Korea, I don't think there's anything very clandestine. I think they're trying to shake money out of the United States. And And lastly, of course, there's Pakistan, which is a very unique case, so I don't think we'll go into that. So let's get back to the one classic case. That is a country which acceded to the NPT breaking out. And that's what non-proliferation, I assume, is the cutting edge of non-proliferation today. If you look at the Libyan case, Libya has been proliferating for something like three decades, between 1970 and 2003. And this proliferation period broadly is divided into two periods, the period before Pakistan came on the scene and the period after Pakistan came on the scene. And we come to know about what they have done after they surrendered all the material to the IAEA in 2003. And it's been analyzed by both the United States and the IAEA. If you look at the first period, you find Libya was given the first reactor by the Soviets in 1969. Although the Americans protested, they said it's a very small reactor. I think it was 10 megawatts. It's insufficient to produce fissile material. But during the first period, the Libyans did succeed in separating plutonium from the spent fuel. And now we know that the Libyans, although they were very close to the primary source of uranium ore, did make six attempts to get uranium hexafluoride from European sources. Eventually, they got that uranium hexafluoride from North Korea through Pakistan. If you look at the phase two of the Libyan proliferation attempts, you find something very different, and that is the whole thing was really run by the intelligence agencies of Libya and Pakistan, who met in Turkey frequently to progress the deal. And since AQ Khan couldn't travel in an open way because he was being followed, the deal was being run by his Sri Lankan assistant. And what did the Sri Lankan assistant do? He set up a dedicated factory to make P1 and P2 centrifuges in Malaysia. It was a regular factory. The Malaysians imported the equipment from the Europeans because it wasn't clear that they were making centrifuges. It was some engineering product. And the whole thing was sold to a company registered in Dubai by the AQ Khan network. And the centrifuges were shipped from Malaysia to Dubai and diverted en route to Libya. So you see that it's a whole complex network of nuclear commerce that was set up. Eventually, of course, the Libyans ran a cascade, I think, of 64 centrifuges, and they had put together a certain number of P2 centrifuges. So what you see is a growing network of nuclear commerce. And during this entire period, particularly after the first reactor came into Libya, Libya had signed the INFERC 66 and 153, which a country would have to sign before getting access to the nuclear reactor. So the IAEA were in Libya, and the Libyans continued to proliferate for 30 years. And this whole nuclear commerce network was set up with the NPT being run. I mean, when I say the NPT, I don't mean that paper document that's signed in by the General Assembly in New York, but the way it is actually run in a country like Libya. Of course, since then, of course, the additional protocol has come in. But I would venture to suggest, I'm not criticizing the IAEA, but that is all the IAEA can really do on the ground. What is it? It is a techno audit kind of organization. And if you have the intrusive additional protocol, you will strengthen the level of that techno audit. But it's like saying, for instance, that you can forever prevent meltdown of a company like Enron if you have auditors, which is not the case. You really need the fraud squad and you need the police. So you're looking at the new phase of non-proliferation. And the new phase of non-proliferation, I venture to suggest, is national technical means and regimes like the NSG and the PSI. Now look at the NSG. Now, this is one regime which the U.S.-India deal actually addresses. It says that India must make its export quality, export legislation, NSG compliant. And that's been done. And it was done before Prime Minister Manmohan even came to the United States to negotiate the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal. But if you look at the NSG, that's 45 countries, you will see that at least 38 or 39 of those countries have a nuclear infrastructure which is less developed than India's. So what sense does it make to have an NSG with India outside the loop? And now that India has made its export regimes NSG compliant, you've really got India as part of the package that is preventing proliferation, but the deal is not through yet. As far as the PSI is concerned, this is something that I must try and explain. There might be apprehensions in the USA as to why India hasn't signed the PSI. I think the PSI was really a good product. It was badly sold. I remember when the PSI came into India, it wasn't clear as to which bureaucracy owned it, actually. Was it the legal guys? Was it the Foreign Office? Was it the Navy? And when the people in India had doubts, it wasn't clear who one went to. And I think India, most analysts in India, misinterpreted the PSI at that stage. But I think they could have been brought around to it, except for the fact that last year, immediately after the deal was signed, when the Indian Foreign Office was thinking about the PSI all over again, there came the SUA, that is Suppression of Unlawful Activities, at sea. So now that looked like a multilateral initiative, and there was a lot of argument in the Foreign Office as to if the multilateral effort, suppression of unlawful activities, is coming through, should we then be seen acceding to the PSI at the same stage? And as Raja said, there are a lot of people in the Indian MEA too who still belong to what he calls the old thinking. And at that stage, I don't think there is any major argument against the PSI. Given time, India will accede to the PSI. The second question is this: the fact that the NPT will be weakened. If I may say that in 1968, when the NPT was open for signature, every country that acceded to the NPT did so with open eyes. I don't think the leadership of those countries, I think countries do what they have to do in national self-interest. They surrender a certain amount of sovereignty when they agree to an international agreement. And the countries that acceded to the NPT knew fully well that there are three states outside the NPT, India, Pakistan, and Israel. So what has changed since then? Has the geopolitical situation of any of the countries that acceded to the NPT changed as a result of the Indian test? I would venture not. If perhaps there's one country whose geopolitical situation has been affected, it's China's. I can't believe that Washington will shed tears if China's geopolitical situation has been affected for the worse. Which brings me to the third point. The fact that Indians might follow an independent foreign policy, this is true. India lives in the same region with a long border with China. China is an emerging superpower. And whether the economists who are running the Indian government today wish it or don't wish it, India might have China as its foremost trading partner in about 10 years. That's the way private sector and business and economics is running. But I don't think you should forget that the Indian strategic community are more than aware that if Delhi is targeted by a nuclear missile, it is a Pakistani missile of Chinese origin. And on top, and at the tip of that missile, is a nuclear device which was given to the Pakistanis by the Chinese. And we have that corroboration with the IAEA right now, which is a 10 kiloton uranium weapon, 453 kgs. We all know all the details of that weapon. So it's true that the Indians haven't said that this deal will haven't verbally said that this will bring India and US closer. But I think all these years, the criticism of the Indian foreign policy was that it was largely declaratory. Now, for once, the foreign policy is not declaratory, but it's more substantial. I don't think India is in a position to be able to say what the United States might like to hear. But then you heard only declaratory policy all these years. India is fully aware of what the dangers from China are. And you see this nuancing that when, say, if the Indian defense minister was with the Chinese defense minister, we at the same time sent the Indian Navy to exercise in the South China Sea. So it's not that the strategic community is unaware of what the Chinese are doing. And we are fully aware that it takes only the signing of one piece of paper to convert Gwadar into a Chinese base in the Indian Ocean. We know all this. but these things may not be said. So I think I've covered these three aspects that the India experts in U.S. criticize the deal for. There's one area which I really cannot comment on, and that is how we are going to prevent Congress from regaining its apparently lost dignity at the speed at which the administration signed this deal. And that's one area which I'm not very familiar with.
Well, I promise you we will not hold you personally responsible for that problem. There are maybe others in the room who are more expert in it. This was not the first time and will not be the last that the Congress felt that it was taken for granted by an administration. This is also a bipartisan problem. Let me now introduce our next speaker, Professor Anupam Srivastav, who's director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Trade and Security at the University of Georgia. Dr. Srivastav teaches on international security, political economy, and Asian affairs. I first met him when I came to the university for a conference on India. Until that point, which was actually a good number of years ago now, I hadn't realized what a center of expertise he had built up. And what he is going to talk about today is a little bit more technical than what we've been talking about, but it's the problem of materials control, which is one of the issues that regularly comes up when people consider where the Indian nuclear program fits in the world. The Admiral has correctly reminded us all that India has made its export controls NSG compatible. But what I've asked Dr. Srivastav to do is to look behind that and to look at ways that this part of the system could become, in some sense, part of the solution and to reassure those who feel that it's part of the problem. So, Dr. Srivastav.
Ambassador Schaefer, thank you very much, both for organizing this event and giving me the opportunity to speak to what Raja Menon correctly said is a very formidable and, I might add, a very distinguished audience. Given the larger cognitive and political changes in the Indian landscape that Raj began with, which I very much endorse and stress, in terms of the Indian position and its refinement and its evolution, as well as moving from a proponent of an idea that is, you know, disarmament, I'll give you one.
We're going to try and give you a little darkness there and hope
right.
Not put all of us in the dark. It's again beyond my technological capabilities.
No, I appreciate it. One of the Indian ambassadors at one point was talking about disarmament at the CD in Geneva, and the Indians toyed with the idea informally. They approached the U.S. and said, how about setting up a standing committee within the CD to talk about zero yield or total disarmament in 100 years? And that idea did not fly. So India does realize that that is more of a utopian concept. And then on to Rajan Menon. And talking about the Indian capability and the refinement of the doctrine, what I'm going to do is take you a step further from that and talk about what are the levels of technology safeguards in India, both via export controls and via nuclear security. Because at the end of the day, these are the enabling mechanisms for safeguarding technologies in a country, and in many ways are both a trade-enabling as well as a security-maximizing tool. When we talk about the nuclear deal and if and when that goes through, and I'll end by talking about the legislation language that is being discussed and will be discussed today going into the markup. If all of this happens, and not just the U.S., but French, Canadian, Russian, and the British technologies go into India, how safe will they be? So this is an attempt at showing you where we are. In terms of the importance of tech safeguards, there is a handout for those of you who have them. For the others, I apologize that you have to crane your necks and look at the slides. One of the goals for India over the last 15 years, early years into the economic reforms, was to push India to emerge as a knowledge-intensive economy. This is both to create high technology segments and high technology production capabilities, which for any of you, if you'll forgive my economics for a second, has a higher marginal product of labor, it has more stability in the market, it has less shifting prices and so on. And when you do the production mix well, meaning when I talk about factors of production, I'm talking about labor, capital, technology, and entrepreneurship. If you calibrate those factors well and you bring in labor into it, then it is also an unemployment-solving tool and has higher returns, and therefore you can use that revenue to expand that market. And that's sort of the model of the knowledge-intensive economy in India, which is working in the IT sector, but with IT as a technical backbone, it's moving rapidly into the biotechnology sector, into value-added automobile manufacturing, and increasingly now positioning itself into the defense market. The French and the others are, and the Russians are moving into that space. The U.S. is very interested. We have people like Mike Gadbois and others who want to also move into the nuclear space. Now, given all of those things, India has to facilitate technology-embedded commerce with the world. It has put into place a WTO-compliant both product and process patent. For those of you who follow that debate, that's a very important distinction. Implementation of that is going to remain a challenge for some years, but the government is gearing up and staffing more on doing that, as well as on the other key issue, which is intangible technology transfers, the ITT, where I'm just flagging one issue. When companies that are locating value-added business in India, they have to encrypt the information that they convey between one unit within India to another unit in India or outside. Now, that encryption for data privacy allows walls to be built around information transfers that might also allow proliferation-relevant information or national security-relevant information to pass through. So the government has to work out a balance between allowing that data privacy level of walls, but also the ability to snoop and look into it to ensure that there is no proliferation-related diversion happening. Some of us, and this is not the place to talk about it, but do work on these issues. There are reports and other things that I am happy to share with any of you if you want, including some work we are doing for this, for the government and for the DRDO, the Defense Research and Development Organization. Now, the other thing that safeguards do is to secure imported and indigenous goods and technologies, which is what the nuclear deal will ultimately also require India to put into place, both against unauthorized re-exports, against diversion within India, and against unauthorized transit and transshipment, which is also very key. India is a node for global commerce in that region, and high value or terrorism related transits and transshipments have to be protected by India when we are talking about creating a civilian nuclear complex and so forth. Therefore, I'm looking at two dimensions here: the export controls and the nuclear security. On the export control side, there are priorities of India that are shifting. You can read on the slide. I won't go over each of those things, but I'll just flag a few. Until the 80s, all of the strategic technologies were controlled by the government of India, and they still are in the nuclear and missile sector, but the private sector had a stronger role and has a much, much stronger role in the chemical and the bio sector. And so the government has to ensure that the industry comes up with its compliance levels up to international standards, and there is a lot of work going on. People like us are going, in fact, even in 2 weeks from now, to do another major dual-use industry workshop in India and working very closely with the government on doing those things. And promoting trade with members of the multilateral regimes. This is not the time and space to talk about India's technology-embedded trade, but the bulk of India's value-added trade is with the European Union and with the U.S. And if you look at U.S.-India economic dialogue and export control dialogue, value-added commerce is the emphasis for both of these countries. The rest of it will follow anyways, and it is happening at a business-to-business level. And for India, for a knowledge-intensive economy aspiration, you have to minimize the impact of deemed exports, which, again, means if you are sharing tangible or intangible information with a foreign national on Indian soil, for example, you still have been deemed to have transferred that knowledge without obtaining an export control license. For a country that wants to operate in this space, it is a very important thing, and the government has to balance between that and the ability to conduct free commerce and free scientific exchange. some of the other new challenges for India to increase the capacity and the technical awareness of the staff that does license reviews of export controls, including of the end use and end user, meaning what is the ended, stated end use of that? How do you authenticate the end use of that transfer that is taking place? How do you authenticate the integrity of the end user that is going to receive these things? And allowing post-shipment verifications of the items to make sure that that indeed is happening. Customs have to be trained to identify more of nuclear and missile dual-use items. You have to protect against the intangible diversions that I've mentioned and move away from the confidentiality agreements that it had to what the U.S. and EU have, more on drawing up very specific legal contracts specifying violations, obligations, and so forth, as well as a couple of technical terms on commodity identification training or product identification training into the online licensing system. What that means is customs and other people should be able to look at visual images to figure out that a what happens in a license case is a product license that has been given, it's been produced, say, in 2 years' time after the license was given, the man has approached customs now saying, here are my goods, I'm going out, here are my license and documentation, but has mislabeled the items to show that he does not require a license because it's not a licensed item. How does the customs person know? And when, what does it trigger? When should he be suspicious to look into it to see whether, in fact, it is a licensed item that is going out? Those kinds of trainings involve commodity and product identification types of things. So a lot of technical work. And the U.S. is working, as well as the Indians are working on in enhancing the capacity of the Indian customs and licensing people to not just do all of these things and identify, but also to have real-time information access to each other and to technical experts on the border at the time of need. You can scan through the phases of export controls just to pick up on Raj's point of the Tata Institute being set up in 1944 and the Atomic Energy Commission set up in 1946, a year before Indian independence. So it's a long-established program. Its focus and emphasis has shifted over time, as you can see on that slide. These are the legal bases of the system, which I'll not dwell upon. I'll show another slide right here to show you where the international law has helped refine or reinforce the Indian national law and what is the result of that on the Indian export control system. Very quickly, going on to the right side, the IAEA conventions have led to the nuclear items being put on the Indian control list. The chemical items after the Chemical Weapons Act. India was a signatory to the CWC, and so those items went onto the Indian control list. The BTWC and the UN conference led to the bioweapons and bio items being put on the list. And the UNSCR 1540 led to the WMD Act, including, and I would say that the WMD Act was in preparation and almost ready before the UNSCR actually came into place. So it simply added a catalyst and provided the government extra political cover to do more intrusive things. But to put intangible technologies, role of brokers in the Indian export business, and transit and transshipment items, as well as catch-alls. I'll explain that in just a second. Look at some of the details of what the WMD Act does do. It closes some of those loopholes that existed in the prior system. And I'll clarify, these were loopholes in terms of formal legislation. In terms of implementation, the staff was still doing many of these things. But now, in a situation where you are inviting more people into the private industry, into the space of export-import, the government's limited staff and capacity to monitor and implement and verify is being strained, and that is why they need to create more formal legislation and train staff who are not aware of the end use and end user and the proliferation networks around the world, and therefore a more formal system is being put into place. Now, specifically, the Act applies to export, transfer, retransfer, transit, and transshipment, meaning it's covering all possible aspects of how proliferation can take place. They cover material, equipment, and technology. It's become much more explicit when you look at all of those definitions. A much more comprehensive definition of technology, which includes intangibles, by Indian citizens abroad. There are people such as I and others who work on programs. Technically, I might have to take a permission from GOI if I'm working on a sensitive project in the United States. And this applies to a host of Indians working in the IT and in the U.S. national security complex. It's a draconian law if enforced. The government, of course, is working very closely bilaterally with the U.S. side in making sure that those programs are not affected and the Indians can continue to work here, as well as by foreign nationals who will increasingly be working in India in the sensitive sectors. The other things it does, along with other steps that are happening with the in the bilateral process, is that the Indian control list has been harmonized with the NSG and the MTCR. I might flag here that the legislation that is going to be debated next week includes a U.S. Position that India also align these with Vasanar and with the Australia group. And I might tell you that about 6 months ago, work on that started and is actually moved quite a bit in India. So this might not be a stretch for India to try and align with the other two regimes also. And with that, India would have harmonized its control list with all of the four multilateral regimes. SCOMET stands for Special Chemicals, Organisms, Materials, and Technology, Equipment and Technology, excuse me. This is the Indian dual-use consolidated list of all nuclear materials, chemical, bio, and advanced conventional munitions. They've been harmonized effectively with the EU and with the U.S. dual-use list and is operating like this for the last several years quite well. Penalties have been expanded. They've been made more explicit. Liabilities have been extended to not just the violator in the firm, but every senior person in the business enterprise. Everybody will be liable. And catch-all. This is the term that the U.S. government uses, where the onus is now shifted on the industry, saying it's your business to know. You cannot say, I did not know, when a case like an NEC engineering happened supplying ammonium perchlorate to Iraq or a front company in Iraq. The company said, we did not know. The Indian government did not have enough adequate rules. They threw the law books at them and indicted the company, but then quickly changed this to say it is your business to do due diligence and you will be held responsible. So the intent of the catch-all clause has now been introduced, and therefore, in turn, it raises the onus on the government to provide, at the time of license request, the information including intelligence and advice to the company on whether or not to even bother to respond to an import request, whether to send an item to a certain entity and so forth, and use their consulates and other intelligence capabilities to help the company decide whether that would be a safe trade, both to export and to import. Let me shift to the other side of India, the nuclear security, the materials and procedures side of things. For DOE guys like John Wolfstall, sorry, John, you're now at the Carnegie Endowment. And I should. And I'm sorry, yes, that's right. Forgive me. Knowing friends from many who've worn different hats over the years does this to you. Indeed. But I'll divide it into physical protection and... I have 4.5 minutes. I'll crunch my talk. I just want to give you a sense. On the physical protection, looking at India's actual nuclear complexes, weapons, and the civilian complexes, there is perimeter protection. These are very sprawling complexes with a very layered design, so you have to almost go in if you've gone to the Chinese and other systems, the Forbidden City type of, you know, layers upon layers. So you don't really have access to the strategic ones unless you are cleared. You do have electronic and human surveillance and access control where, for example, a staff permitted to work in Unit 1 will have to have written permission to travel into Unit 2, enter into Unit 2 and so on. And individual labs have designated people who can come in through their valid IDs and so forth. So there are those kinds of checks that people like us who have visited these labs and some other labs in some other countries can verify does exist. On the material control and accounting side of things, there are, again, proportional access badges. The fissile material that scientists are using are weighed before and after their experiments because on the Russian side, and many of us work on that under the CTR, can tell you that some of the smartest smuggling that happened was simply in the weighing in and out process. And you can steal small amounts over a period of time and then sell it on the market for whatever. Regular internal audits are conducted at least twice a year. The Atomic Energy Regulatory Board conducts its own oversight and technical and other kind of techno audit, actually. And periodically, the Controller and Accountant General of India conducts more of a revenue/administrative audits. These are some of the treaties that India has been a signatory to. I'll not go over them, but this is intended to show you that India is not starting afresh with these things. It's been long a member of these things. And of the IAEA conventions, being not just on the board and one of the early members, but also one that contributes a significantly large technical staff to the IAEA's technical mission of conducting enforcement and verification missions across the world. And India does do that, has been doing it for many years. These last three slides. I'm talking about nuclear security just to do an assessment. What are the areas of strength? The reactor design safety is fairly, fairly strong in India, especially of the 220-megawatt design. Kalpakkam was one of the facilities that was flooded after the tsunami. It was immediately shut down. Flooding was, the water was cleaned and the thing was cleared and resumption was done in record time. The IAEA noted that with appreciation and has organized a conference to learn how that was done. And countries like Japan, which run one of the largest nuclear programs of land-based power reactors, is actually very interested in a bilateral dialogue to learn how they can do or adopt some of those things. Safety of fuel storage facilities in India is fairly strong. Physical security of nuclear materials is fairly good, and that is why, as Admiral Menon said, the Department of Atomic Energy in India conducts regular training programs for not just Indian scientists, but also on behalf of IAEA for a number of regional countries. And, of course, the Indian four reactors that are under safeguards and the other 12 that will come under safeguards under the separation plan will be part of the 66 REV2, but this will change, and, in fact, the IAEA oversight will go up in what is being negotiated, and that is a India-US-IAEA safeguards agreement that is very much happening, and it's making fairly, fairly strong progress. I wouldn't venture to guess, but I would say a matter of 8 to 10 weeks worth of technical work remains to be done, but it's going well. And that's why you will see Dr. Albarade's statements about India's capacity in this direction. Areas in need of improvement require training for non-technical personnel in India on security procedures, stronger background check on non-critical transportation and personnel, safety of nuclear material during transport within India, nuclear waste disposal, and periodically the prickly relationship between the regulatory bodies and the nuclear facilities, as well as from terrorism standpoint, overflight and safety issues above Indian nuclear facilities are some of the issues that they need to work on. Last slide is talking about what are the improvements you can expect if the deal comes through. India's harmonization of export controls with international best practices is going to continue. It already, for people like us who rank both as a teacher as well as somebody who conducts periodic assessments of national cases, gives India a fairly high mark on export controls. On enhanced security and information sharing, this is another important thing that's going to happen in the civilian nuclear complex. The entities that are going to be placed in this, the scrutiny of their business operations, their proliferation, related background checks will be very, very strong now in India, because you will have all these countries' facilities located within these complexes and with IAEA permission required in moving things within and between these facilities. So a lot of this will happen. International caliber safety obviously will happen in the nuclear complex. And osmotic learning, while government will not brook any interference into the weapons complex, the lessons learned on safety on the civilian side will naturally be applied by the government on the weapons side. And finally, in terms of efficiency of production of nuclear power in India, that will be done by foreign-owned companies in India. That will drive and raise the bar for performance of Indian-owned and Indian-operated power sector units, and therefore the gains of that will also apply over time to the Indian production units. So in conclusion, what you have is an Indian capacity that is neither new nor weak. I have tried to outline, as Tezi had asked me to, areas where India is strong, as well as areas where it might need some improvement. And ultimately, as I said, these are the technical entrails of the system that India has in place to safeguard if and when the nuclear commerce or the nuclear deal comes through, not just with the U.S., but with the other powers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anupam. A lot of material to squeeze into, probably not enough time. Our final speaker on the panel is Dan Poneman, whom I've asked to respond, but I know he's got an idea of his own that he wants to launch. Dan, I'm going to ask if you can wind up by 11:30 because two of the people around the table I know have to leave early, and I want to make sure we hear from them as we kick off our more general discussion.
Thank you. That's 10 minutes more than I usually get, so I'm grateful.
We're all hard.
I'll try to finish talking before you finish listening. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for setting this session up. I asked Tezi when she first called me, what is the purpose of the N+1 meeting on Indian and U.S. nuclear cooperation? And the premise, which I accepted and is why I think we're all here, is let's assume we're on the other side of this big debate, and what is the future, how does it look, and can it serve our mutual interests? So I will just stipulate that we're starting from the same premise of the nuclear deal is done. The Congress has acted, the NSG has acquiesced or knuckled under, depending on your point of view, and the IAEA safeguards is in place, that further stipulate that we now have a active build-out of nuclear energy, not just in India and the U.S., but indeed in many countries of the world, and third, that we still have a very, very tough set of proliferation problems. Iran, North Korea, some of us have a pet rock about Brazil, and who knows who comes next. If Iran goes, I think Saudi and others and so on. And I think the question then presented is, once we're in this future, we're past all these agreements, the deal is in place, what's the future? And I'm smiling because Mike Gamba and I have had a running dialogue on these two futures, and as I'm sitting here this morning, I'm reminded of the question, how can you tell the dating couple from the married couple in a pizza parlor? And the answer is the couple that's dating is saying, you take the last piece. No, you. And the married couple said, you already had four. So I want to find out which it's going to be. And just to kind of flesh this out a little bit, the sort of happy view of this is we now have signed up, and this will actually, just to be clear, begin to bring in our Indian colleagues' comments. I'm going to make a few specific comments about them, and then I will launch this little idea, a modest proposal. We accept it basically same set of norms. We have much greater clarity about a shared set of objectives. We have tighter cooperation, and indeed, I think Anupam put very clearly what that means in real terms and saves me a bunch of time in trying to explain what it means, and he knows it much better anyway. We are each exercising the leadership we enjoy in different fora to some generally common purpose, and that we have now achieved a general level of strategic partnership that all of us on every side of the nonproliferation and other issues have said is our objective going back years and years. And I'm reminded of Tom Pickering in his tenure in India in 1993 trying to get something like this launched, and frankly there just wasn't enough political oomph at the highest levels to make the effort worth the candle, and obviously all of the tremendous economic interdependence that can bring great prosperity to both of our sides, or we have the not-so-good future, which is everyone is still hedging, that and in fact, Roger Menon mentioned this in his third criticism, that India is still kind of playing the traditional independent foreign policy role, which is very understandable in India terms, but has been sometimes problematic from a U.S. perspective, that they're still cranking out more and more fissile materials without restraint, and that this has had a negative or will continue to have a negative effect in terms of other countries' nuclear activities, and that we don't really get there on PSI in a meaningful way. So I think the question presented then is which future is it going to be? And I couldn't do, frankly, better than Raja Menon in describing kind of the critical issues, not only in terms of concerns about the current deal, but actually those are forward-looking concerns that I think relate directly to which of these two futures we're going to confront. And so I would just like to make very brief comments on each of the three areas that he mentioned. Will the nonproliferation regime per se and kind of all of its various extensions be weakened? And indeed, this is the critical point. And I think that there will be a number of areas in which we can see the possibility of, and I'd like to try to embrace the possibility of strengthening the regime, notwithstanding what I'm going to say about the second piece on the NPT itself. That is to say, as we all know, there are many, many pieces of the regime that extend beyond its cornerstone, the Nonproliferation Treaty. And we've talked about most of them this morning. We have export controls. We have PSI. We have diplomacy. Indeed, one thing we haven't talked about much, which we will need to, is we have fuel cycle. And I would stipulate, just as we have said so many years, going back a dozen, 15 years in U.S. nonproliferation policy about China and Russia, if India, like those others, is not part of the solution, it will be part of the problem. It's just too big. It's just too important. It just has too many equities, too many capabilities. And if we cannot embrace them in the regime, then I think we will all be not only the poorer for it, but the less safe for it. And in that respect, I think you would find a broad consensus extending throughout the nonproliferation community, even among those who are not enthusiastic about this deal, to say, yes, we do need to work together in these areas. I would say, and the one more specific comment I'll make about Anupam's remarks is that that's a great start, and the question is going to be, can we execute on the plan? You've got the premise of what's been done before. You have the added information about what India is presently doing, and, of course, as always, the key is going to be how well all of this can be executed, not only, of course, by India, but by the United States and all other countries. So I think that you can go down that list. How can we work, and it can be very, very quietly indeed, in terms of genuine interdiction. You will have in India tremendous sources, intelligence and other sources. You'll have assets we cannot ever aspire to that will give you windows into various areas of nuclear proliferation that could make us very effective collectively. So that to me is the question presented. And indeed, I think your point could not be more well taken that with respect to export controls, that the Nuclear Suppliers Group is a forum in which there is a gaping hole in terms of its ability to be effective if, in fact, India does not somehow come into that grouping and work with us in a very cooperative way. Your second point in terms of the NPT itself. Here I think you do have a real problem because, number one, I still believe that the Nonproliferation Treaty itself matters. It establishes a norm. I couldn't agree more that it has been subscribed to out of the self-interest of nations. And indeed, I think the way we got it extended in 1995, which again Tom and others will well recall, is by frankly taking the issue back away from the arms controllers and asking the heads of state and heads of government who had subscribed and their successors who had subscribed to the treaty to begin with, do you still believe it serves your self-interest? And the answer was yes. So I think the challenge before us now, and this will bring in Raja Mohan's first point. He made two points, one of which I found scary and one of which I found inspiring, and this was the scary one. If you walk around and you talk to various governments that are faithful adherents to the NPT, they are not indifferent to the grounds upon which exceptions get made to that regime. And indeed, in another session I remember very shortly after the May 98 tests that I participated in, it was suggested by some of our colleagues that what we really needed to do is take the NPT and carve into it a new category. Guess who was the first delegate out of his seat? The Japanese. Not the deal we signed up for. Don't like it, not going to live with it, and so on. So I think, and that's why I'm to be candid, a little concerned by the first point and something that I have felt is worrisome, is if the justification for the Indian exception is because we're India, or we like India, or India is the biggest democracy and all that. This, it's very, very hard to sustain any rule-based system on exceptionalism. That's why the U.S. Constitution says you cannot have a bill of attainder, right? You can't have kind of names, legislation that is keyed on the unique attributes, because I'd like to know which governments of the world say, we're the same as everyone. And you know, one man's India is another man's Pakistan, for example, beginning with the Pakistanis. And so I think it's a dangerous precedent to say we're making an exception because we like us and we're different, as opposed to – and but the interesting thing is there's also in both remarks of my colleagues here a lot that can be said about criteria-based approach to the NPT issue about implementation of export controls, a variety of things, that most of which have been adduced in the July 18th statements and elsewhere, that I think could actually build up to a very credible argument that, say, any country that meets this set of 92 criteria can get this kind of treatment. Now, we all know, practically speaking, that's not going to happen, but I think it's a way to guard against a what could be a dangerous erosion of the NPT, which then I think would adversely affect the broader regime. And then the final point on the independent foreign policy, and here I find I think this is an absolutely critical point. The United States does not need another echo. Not that we have that many, but we don't need an echo. And I think one of the big, big mistakes that we often make in our foreign policy is not to understand that when we, after all, who had set up the IAEA and other organizations, work with other nations and with other international organizations, we get a legitimizing function, not because they're the same as we are, but because they are different, and because they have different sets of constituencies, and because they achieve in their own terms a certain kind of legitimacy. So what does that mean in terms of India and the U.S. in moving forward, and whether we have a bright or a dark future together? It says to me that we don't expect, and it's impossible, that two great nations with as diverse experiences, equities, interests, and characteristics as ours are going to agree on everything. But we ought to agree on the big things. And we ought to find a way to forge some kind of a common and coordinated policy on the big things. And let's just be frank. The acid test here is Iran. And this has come up many times. It was a big, big deal here, of course, when we got the two votes from India in September and in February on the last time the IAEA Board of Governors sent the issue to the UN Security Council. And there was, frankly, a setback when we found India supporting the non-aligned statement movement that was quite unhelpful. So while I think we can understand that in different fora different things get said, I think, again, the acid test will be, what is the government of India saying to the government of Iran? And if we can work together there, and the public perception of this can be quite different, and that's fine. But what's happening internally in the direct discussions between those two governments is the kind of thing moving forward that I think, again, will determine whether we have a bright or a dark future together. Now, my last – and I'm on target for the 11:30 line. My last point is a modest proposal, and it actually still fits within the framework of our speaker's earlier comments. When Secretary of State Rice came back from India last year, and it was very, very clear – the direction that U.S. policy was going to be taking, and the events subsequently in the July 18th statement and then the more recent March joint statement have borne out, the question presented, I think, to all of us is, okay, we need to get to a new future with India that has all of these other aspects, the strategic cooperation, the economic cooperation, indeed, perhaps the nuclear cooperation. We have to reconcile ourselves to a new reality. May 98 happened. We're not going to wind back the clock. We had long since given up the mantra of just sign the NPT and get done with it. So the question presented is, how can we get to that future in a way that does not unravel the NPT, that does not unravel the NPT regime and all of its various expressions? And it seemed to me at that time that what you want to do is to find some way in which India could actually show leadership in a way that is not actually tied directly to the NPT, but confers genuine non-proliferation value. That way you could say, if I'm the United States can justify making an exception to a big rule that we worked very hard for many, many years to get emplaced and embraced widely, which is the full-scope safeguards rule. We can make an exception because not just because India is India, but because they've done something that is very important in nonproliferation space that's helpful. And I thought, well, we got the president's February 04 fuel cycle proposal, which says we don't want to have a lot of countries. Indeed, we don't want to have any more countries that are not already commercial enrichers and or commercial reprocessors get into this business. It's just too dangerous. And if you think of the big build-out of nuclear energy that many people project, where the people like in the MIT study saying that you would have up to 500 gigawatts of installed nuclear power by mid-century, in other words, a trebling of current installed base. And if you think of fuel cycle facilities expanding into more countries at a similar clip, it is absolutely hair-raising to anybody who worries about nuclear weapons spread. So how could India help in that respect? And by the way, if they help in that respect, that's got nothing to do with the NPT. And therefore, it's something, because the NPT does not get at that issue, any benefit India confers in that space is not it does not derogate from the NPT. And so if you create an exception based on that above and beyond leadership India could show, then I think it's not corrosive of the NPT bargain. So the notion was, well, look, if India says we need a lot more nuclear power ourselves and we're going to import a bunch of it, and let's just say we're going to import a bunch of light water reactors, why don't we lease the fuel? Why don't we say we got this Mysore enrichment facility, we've got the reprocessing stuff, that's on the strategic side. We're not going to use that for our import for our imported light water reactors. For the imported light water reactors, we'll lease that fuel, and therefore, for that period of the fuel leasing, we're not going to be building enrichment facilities. We're not going to be building reprocessing facilities for that fuel because we won't need it. Indeed, we won't have title to that fuel. That fuel title will never pass from the lessor to the lessee, in which case the lessee is the Indian entity. Now, what does this do? Number one, it, I think, shows a proof of concept that there is a way to take what began as the President Bush's February 04 fuel cycle initiative and take it out of kind of the thou shalt not hectoring mode and into a pragmatic, commercially based leasing mode that has the same nonproliferation benefit without the political downside. And it shows that countries like Iran and Brazil could possibly do the same thing. It's not any problem from a Indian perspective in their strategic program because that's doing what it's doing on its side anyway. So it's a contained initiative that would have a significant nonproliferation benefit. Now my nonproliferation colleagues might complain and say, hey, yeah, but now you've freed up all that other material. And to which I said, well, you're right. Sorry, I wanted a freeze too. We're not getting a FISMAT freeze. This is the next best thing. And oh, by the way, this sets up a commercially based mechanism that can absorb material. So since the formal Indian position is that of a minimal deterrent, though as yet undefined how minimal is, this thing is a mechanism that could absorb any material out of the strategic side of the Indian program at such time as they wish to make it available. And again, people like Tom Pickering will remember the U.S.-Russian HEU deal. So I see this as not violating Article 1 of the NPT necessarily, as providing a mechanism commercially based to get at the nonproliferation problem. It's an idea that I think could be accepted, and I'll make one last comment about this because I have discussed this with some of our Indian friends and colleagues, including in Delhi in January, and the first time I mentioned this, my Indian interlocutor said, well, that's fine. That's within the four corners of the July 18th statement. And I said, oh, really? Where is that? And sure enough, I have somewhere here, but I won't find it in the interest of time. Oh, I do. I have it right here. On July 18th, the Prime Minister conveyed a bunch of things, including refraining from transfer of enrichment and reprocessing technologies to states that do not have them, which I did remember, and supporting international efforts to stop their spread. It's not recutting the deal. Last point, when my friends from the Congress called up and said, hey, we read about this. I'd written a little thing on this idea, and we want to put it in the legislation. I said, don't do that. Don't do that, because as soon as you do that, you turn it into a coercive knuckling under thing. This is an opportunity, I think, for India, not the U.S., to show some leadership in a way that I think will help make sure that, and again, I'll close by commenting on Raja Mohan's comment. The inspirational part was his very final peroration of how we could find a new strategic future together. And this is not the be-all and end-all. This kind of mechanism, I think, is the kind of thing that might not have been available in the past, that might be available now, that will get us to an energy-rich, carbon-free, electricity-emitting future that does not have the deleterious effects that some people have adduced in terms of implementation of the U.S.-Indian nuclear accord.
Thank you, Tom. Bob?
Thank you, Tejji. I thought those were four excellent presentations. And I won't comment on the nuclear deal other than to say, given my prediction, I think the deal is going to survive the U.S. Congress intact. I think Congress will add a few additions to it. Some of them will be annoying to both the Bush administration and to India, but won't change the substance of the deal. They will not be killer amendments. The only question is when. I think the House will act this summer. The Senate may take a bit longer. That was foreshadowed in some remarks by John McCain. But I think whether it's this summer or early 2007, it's going to survive and it's going to be adopted. Let me move on to the future rather than the past, to say that I've always felt that if U.S. and India can somehow resolve this cluster of issues we call the nuclear issue, that we are natural allies, to coin a phrase, in fighting proliferation. I think we have a commonality of interests. We've demonstrated that commonality already in a number of areas. We talk about PSI, but there already has been U.S.-Indian cooperation on interdiction, on interdicting this North Korean vessel at an Indian port, which was a treasure trove of information about North Korean missile exports and technology and so forth. Export control, we've worked together, WMD terrorism, and there's a full agenda out there for making us real partners. Dan mentioned cooperating and limiting the spread of fuel cycle technologies. That's an interesting idea that Dan mentioned, but I think we can find a way that is consistent with India's own fuel cycle programs to make that possible. We can cooperate in nuclear security, ensuring that best practices are used in India and in the U.S. and throughout the world in protecting these installations and materials from theft and seizure. 1540, the Security Council resolution Apunam mentioned. India is not obviously yet a member of the G8 or the G9 or whatever, but the G8 Global Partnership to prevent the spread of nuclear materials and protect them and so forth. It would be good if India associated itself in some fashion with that and even became a donor and teacher for its region and the world. Would be very constructive. Black market networks. This is a critical problem the U.S. is trying to work on. U.S. and India can work together on eradicating these black market networks. India has some practice in procurement through those networks. It has expertise that it can share with us. Missile defense is an area where we've done some work and continue to do it. But I just want to mention three areas where I think we haven't yet fully reconciled U.S. And Indian approaches. One is dealing with the so-called states of proliferation concern, and Dan mentioned it. Iran is the key case at present. India bought some goodwill with the two votes in the Board of Governors. One was an easy vote because India had China, Russia, Brazil, and Egypt as partners. One was a harder one in September. That bought some goodwill. The non-aligned movement statement and India's failure to disassociate itself from that, I think, has caused some ill will in the U.S. Congress among some influential players. But I agree with Dan that the key issue here is not whether you associate yourself with a NAM statement or whether you vote for a Board of Governors resolution, the key thing is whether India is putting its diplomatic muscle behind persuading Iran to forego enrichment. Russia and China have put their diplomatic weight behind that. They've intervened in Tehran privately, forcefully. They're being a pain in the neck on Security Council and what you do there, but still, I think they genuinely have tried. I have no indication that India has tried, and it's important that India be a partner on these kinds of issues. The second question, strategic restraint. Here is an area where India has almost asserted an exceptionalism. When Manmohan Singh went before the Lok Sabha and started talking about the deal, the key defense was this does not affect our strategic programs in any way. Now, I understand why he had to assert that, because that was a principal source of criticism. But unlike Russia and the Soviet Union before it, the U.S., France, Britain, and so forth, India has not been prepared to accept any limitation on its strategic programs. Maybe it's too soon after May 98 for India to do that, but India has talked about credible minimum deterrent capability. I remember in the Strobtalba Jaswant Singh discussions, there was a long discussion of this, and we would ask the Indian side, are you ready to stop producing fissile material for nuclear weapons? No, not yet. Need more plutonium for our credible minimum deterrent. When do you think? Check with us in a few years. Perhaps we'll have enough soon. Rick remembers these discussions. When is enough enough? And one question I have of our Indian friends is, has Indian thinking about a credible minimum deterrent changed in the last year or two when, India is in a different place in the world? It's now, the other Asian, giant, superpower. Are you thinking about your deterrent needs differently? But I think this is an area, if you're going to be a real partner with the U.S. in fighting proliferation, this is an area where we have to have a meeting of the minds. And finally, the NPT. Does having a new order mean scrapping entirely the old order? I don't think it can mean that. I think Indians do recognize, the thoughtful ones, that the NPT is indispensable in terms of establishing certain norms and legitimacy for some more you can't have a PSI without an NPT and so forth. I think we have to find a way of, and Indians have to find a way, to stop demonizing the NPT. It's begun, but it isn't concluded yet, and recognize that the new order has got to include elements of the old order.
Thank you very much. I am going to give you all a chance to respond, but Bill had his hand up, and I think it's useful to these are very substantive comments, and I think it's useful to give you a little bit more material to work with.
If I can. This is a fascinating discussion, and I'm not a nuclear expert, so I'll defer to those who work on that. But what I am concerned about is listening to the discussion around the table. Is that old saying that we may be sleeping in the same bed with different dreams? If you listen to the discussion, I don't think that India, and I think Bob put it well, India sees itself as the third superpower. All right, there's the United States, there's China, and there's India. And for us to more or less expect India to follow our lead almost everywhere, the Indian, Manmohan Singh is not going to be a spear carrier like Tony Blair or Junichiro Koizumi. It's just not going to happen. So our policy has to be based on allowing some differences with India. And so at this point, a lot of work and a lot of attention on this agreement, but it's going to be a hell of a party. I'm just worried about the hangover the next morning.
I'm going to give our speakers a chance if they want to respond to specific points. Let me suggest, though, that you not make a whole new speech because I'll give you a chance for sort of wrap-up comments at the end. But there may have been some specific comments, and I will take down hands as I see them. Raja?
I think let me associate myself with many of the thoughts that had come across from our American friends. And I think once this deal is through, I mean, we need to look at a whole new agenda in terms of how we build on this cooperation. I think the idea that Dan talked about, as you said, I mean, even when the February 2004 proposal came, India welcomed that set of initiatives. We then studied it, and we found that there was some ambiguity about additional protocol, which was sorted out on July 18. So there is a basis to cooperate. But don't make the mistake of, you know, what you rightly said, if you're constantly throwing it at in front of legislation, this is what India must do, then you have a reasonable chance India won't do that. I mean, I think the way the domestic politics play out, that I would say once this is over, we can put down what Bob said, a whole range of these ideas. We can work on it. We can talk about it, whether track one, track two, various levels. We need to see how we can take many of these ideas forward. In relation to Dan's proposal, I mean, I think I just have one. I think India would like to eventually emerge as the one of the supplier countries in the GNA program. That we've already supported the notion that enrichment and reprocessing should not be exported. But I can tell you, you are friends in our Atomic Energy Commission who still don't want to, who are not sure how this will play out. They've held back. So my sense is, if the confidence begins to be built, if this agreement begins to get implemented, my own sense is our own atomic energy people are deeply suspicious given the Tarapur experience, would come around and say, look, there are advantages in working with the international system. And I think that will eventually happen, and many of the ideas we have here must be taken forward. On the exceptionalism point, look, that's a reality. Now, that's the reality on which this deal has been constructed. But that does not mean you can't cooperate or that this exception is going to break down the rest of it. I don't think that necessarily follows. So while we can't run away from the reality that it is built on that notion, and that we got to deal with that to the best of our ability we can. And the gains are in terms of how you can get India to cooperate on a range of issues. Let me just finish with the thought that what Ambassador Clark said, he's not a nuclear expert. I would say that's a big advantage. in fact, the groupthink, I think, in the 1990s, within the non-proliferation community, under the assumption that the world is a constant, the U.S. power is unchallenged, therefore you can merely dictate a set of rules to the rest of the world. That world has passed. Given the rise of China, given you see what's happening in the Middle East, you need friends. You need to work with friends. And those friends will differ on some issues. Therefore, unless you adapt and relate the non-proliferation objectives to the larger challenges the U.S. is facing, we're not going anywhere on the non-proliferation thing. So I would say put this in the larger context and not see that you don't have the luxury anymore of either dealing with human rights, non-proliferation, as if it is a free run without any consequences for the rest of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. You had your hand up.
Yeah. I think there's one ghost in the cupboard here which no one's really mentioning, and that is, what is your position on India's fuel cycle? It's a very unique fuel cycle. It's a plutonium-heavy fuel cycle. And unless you take a stand on this, I think we will be beating around the bush. This fuel cycle is plutonium-heavy. That can cause either concern or it can make one feel relaxed. Because the plutonium can't go to a bomb program and fuel the fast breeders. So, I mean, what is the position here? Is the position here that this Indian fuel cycle is not worth pursuing because it's too unusual? This is an issue on which people don't really come out with an opinion. It's an unusual fuel cycle. I wouldn't even say that it's been extraordinarily commercially successful. It's been technologically successful, commercially not. But I would be surprised if this country, above all, which is the home of entrepreneurship and bold examples in industrial evolution or revolution, would say that the Indian fuel cycle is not going to work. I mean, is that the position? If that's the position, and if the position is that India must switch over to light water, then you can say you can cap your fissile material program quickly. But if you say that the Indian fuel program must be given a chance to run, and let's face it, I mean, I'm as critical as anybody else about the success of the Indian fuel program, but by God, it's very exciting. Supposing it works. Supposing it just does work, maybe later than it should, it's going to be an extraordinary technological achievement. Should one give it a chance? But if you're going to give it a chance, then it's quite clear that India's fissile material stocks are going to grow very, very slowly, because you can't accrete fissile material stocks and charge up fast breeder reactors every few years. You've got to take a stand on this, and then I think the other issues will resolve itself.
Very quick, just a very few points. I'm in general agreement with most comments. I think Bob Einhorn made a very – he's gone – a very important point that we shouldn't lose sight of, which is whatever we do on the proliferation front should be additional to, not amending of or in replacement of what we've already got, because it will fall apart. We could not possibly – start an amendment process of the NPT without having the whole thing unravel. So let's let whatever be done outside of the four corners of the NPT and be additional to it. On Rajamohan's points, the exceptionalism, absolutely, that's the fact. That's the fact. But the art of diplomacy and, in fact, you know, going back to Hobbes and Locke, is taking these naked power facts and clothing them with a plausible, legitimate cover that will be believed and accepted by others. And that's why it matters. It matters how you argue for this, even if the underlying reality is what you describe it, which I don't think anyone could deny. And on the other point, in terms of India's participation in the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, I would pray that for something like this modest fuel leasing proposal, we could talk about that without getting wrapped up in the other, because if it has to go along with declaring India a supplier of something, that they've got this little Mysore facility as a basis, we're going to get back into some of the old conversations. So I agree with you. Let's get past this discussion. Let's sit down in a small room and kind of brainstorm that. And then the last point, a very fascinating point you raised on the fuel cycle. From April 7th, 1977 until this February, you would have had a problem with the United States of America with that statement, but now you don't. And one of the huge opportunities here, and I don't even know what I think about this yet, because there's lots of implications we have not thought through, is how can we now think about, as nuclear enters a possibly new phase in which the scarcity of the uranium resources have become much more acute, how do we think about working with India on some of these issues in a way that we can work together and not at odds?
Very brief. Actually, much of that has been covered. We talked about PSI, and I can simply say that, adding to Admiral Menon's comments earlier, India is fairly actively discussing this. Once the international law aspects and interdiction principles and the mechanics of working with foreign intel with the Indian intel for interdiction can be sorted out, it's fairly close to doing this. CSI we did not talk about, but India does have its largest inland port, which is CSI compliant now for the last year and a half. And is moving forward with that in some other areas too. Gen 4 and GNEP has been discussed. I'll simply say that it's probably a good idea to allow this to happen for a few more years, as Admiral Menon was saying, because I think India can be both a technology contributing and a fuel receiving partner in all of this. And on Iran, I'll simply add quickly that these public statements that have come out from the U.S. have actually hardened or complicated and complicated the Indian ability to actually vote its national interest, which happens to coincide with the U.S. national interest. So in a paradigm-shifting agreement such as this, one has to be sensitive of how it can be sold, how that new position can be sold by the other side, and that has to be taken into account, and that will help the Indian political leadership generate the strategic gravitas to take these paradigm-shifting steps that they're being asked to do, and they are taking it, by the way, and that is why the NSG Plus kind of Indian agreement not to export reprocessing technologies to outside. This is something NSG has not agreed on, but India is already committed to doing that. So I'll just add those few. Thanks.
Tacey,
thank you very much for this this session. I think a lot of us have been attending probably more meetings and discussions about the U.S. nuclear agreement than we would like to count. For me, by far, this has been the best. The looking to the future of what this agreement will unlock in terms of the possibilities for U.S.-Indian cooperation, this has been refreshing. This has been, as opposed to the point, counterpoint, pro, non-pro arguments, this is looking to the future. And I was also very relieved to hear various comments about the view that this agreement will go through without the kind of killer poison pill amendments. This is encouraging to hear. And it will do that which many of us have wanted to see for some time, going back indeed to the Clinton years, certainly to the Council on Foreign Relations, Asia Society report in 2003, how to bring India into the global nonproliferation regime inside the tent. I mean, this is what Mohammad al-Baradei has been saying. He said, make these countries a partner, not a pariah in this effort, and we will have new areas of cooperation. So this has been a great session. I do want to pick up on a couple of things very quickly, something that I find particularly disturbing. We are looking at those things that we would like to see India do that goes beyond this. Raja made the very important point, don't phrase it what India must do, but I'd like to say what the United States must do. If we want to see further nonproliferation cooperation, the United States has to get its nonproliferation house in order. We are the ones that defeated in the U.S. Senate the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Under what sort of stretch of the imagination do we have the ability now to call on India to sign and to, you know, move away from its current position of a moratorium on nuclear testing to demand that they sign it when we have defeated it? FMCT, we know who the problem has been on FMCT in Geneva. It's been the United States and this administration's view that there is no verification provision. Well, countries aren't going to buy on to an FMCT without verification and compliance, and it can be done. Senator Sam Nunn has said that the U.S. and the U.S. and India should work together to demonstrate its seriousness of actually moving toward an FMCT. That's a good idea, but the U.S. has to do its part on that as well. We have a lot of things we need to do. And what Tom Pickering was talking about, the FMCT, will require the U.S. doing certain things as well, including the concerns that many of us have that this administration would like to see new types of nuclear weapons and possibly leaving open the possibility of resumption of testing on our part. So I think it is a fair thing to say what the U.S. must do if we want to unlock these areas of cooperation. Anupam has raised one very – I want to just throw in one more area of cooperation. We've heard several and Dan's interesting proposal and what Tom had to say. Looking at the slides on nuclear security, as I see these slides, I think of Nunn Lugar and a global Nunn Lugar. And the idea of being able to work closely with India on those kinds of issues and, you know, the global clean out, which is parts of the Nunn Lugar program, this would be a great area for the two countries to work on. So I think that you know, the first step in this process is to get this agreement concluded and concluded in such a way that both countries can, you know, can go along with it. But then I think that having India inside this tent is going to open up a lot of new avenues, and I think that this is hopefully just the first of other sessions that you'll have, Tacey, to explore what kind of interesting ideas we can pursue once this deal is done. Thank you.
I have a question and comment on two issues. The first one was raised by Raja Mohan and the second one by Admiral Raja Menon. The first one is Raja Mohan's comment that the BJP's resistance to the deal has largely to do with domestic politics, but the recent letters given to the president 2 days back raised serious concern about the deal signed by former prime minister and his senior ministerial colleagues in BJP. And it seems that the BJP is not comfortable with the idea of limitations on capping fissile material production and possible testing in future. So my question is, under what circumstances will a future Indian government resume testing? And the second question is about the nuclear fuel cycle policy adopted by India, this famed three-stage program. Recently, the Red Book, which is a Bible for uranium resources, global resources and reserves, they've come out with an assessment which suggests that there's enough conventionally mined uranium to fuel even substantial increases in civilian nuclear power over the next 100 to 150 years. So under this condition, it is not going to make any economic sense to reprocess spent fuel for the next 150 years. So what kind of justification would the Indian three-stage program have now? And the breeder program has been the sticking point in this whole negotiation between India and U.S. And for outside, even though I have tracked Indian nuclear program for several years now, and I do believe that it's not a weapons program. The breeder program is not a weapons program, but it may look like one for outsiders. So how has India tried to dispel these concerns to constituencies outside the U.S.?
Thank you. Mike Miazza, I'm a student of U.S. foreign policy. I have a question for Dr. Mohan. You, in your summary of history, you touched upon 1944, 64, 94, and 98, but you skipped 1954. I learned about this last week when the Federation of American Scientists held a conference and released the letter it sent to all the members of the Congress opposing the U.S.-India deal. During that conference, one of the presenters said, India imported reactor and heavy water from Canada and the United States back in 1954. And the agreement stated that this provision of technology from Canada and the United States to India is for peaceful purpose only. 20 years later, India exploded its first nuclear device, and according to their explanation, the plutonium used for this nuclear device was extracted from the Canadian reactor in violation of the agreement. My question is very short and simple. Is this true or not? And I'm asking this question because if true, it will undermine the administration's portrayal of India as a good guy and would send a bad signal to the governments in the Middle East and in the Northeast Asia that it's okay for a government to violate international agreement, and once you have nuclear weapons, that fait accompli will work in your favor.
Last question.
I'm John Schlosser. For the last 3 years, I've been the principal advisor to the Assistant Secretary for South Asia on Nonproliferation Policy. First of all, let me just comment a little bit on the state of play. The day before yesterday, I was in 6 hours' worth of meetings with Congress, and I think we're narrowing the gaps in both houses, and we should be able to have a markup on Tuesday and Wednesday in both houses of a bill or bills that will have to be reconciled in conference that we can live with. There are problems, but I think they can be overcome. Just wanted to raise a couple of points, mainly to the attention of our Indian guests. I think that there's been a little bit of glossing over of the distinction between harmonization with the regimes, the Nuclear Suppliers Group and Missile Technology Control Regime, and adherence. The July joint statement calls for adherence, and we have to think about the next step in this initiative beyond the Congress amending the legislation. And by the way, it's shaping up to be a two-stage process, as you know. The Congress will get another bite of the apple when it gets the opportunity to approve the bilateral cooperation agreement. But an important next phase will be to secure the assent of the entire membership of the Nuclear Suppliers Group. And we think that the government of India would do itself a service rather than sort of get stuck in a chicken and egg situation over should we adhere now or wait until, as the Indian preference is, the regimes have adjusted their policies to accommodate India, that they would send a strong signal of their intent to cooperate with the regimes by adhering now. But let me draw a problem to your attention. I think this gets to important sovereignty questions, which is to adhere to the regimes, you have to subscribe to the principle that you will keep your controls consonant with those of the regimes in the future. And India, of course, will not be considered for actual membership, but rather adherence. So this is looming out there as an issue. I think it's, potentially an important issue. I think it's one that can be, addressed. But let's not, like I said, gloss over the distinction between harmonization, which the Indians have very usefully done, and actual adherence. And then finally, just a comment on Raja Menon's point on the Indian nuclear fuel cycle being such a distinctive one, and I agree with that. But I would point out, and many people may not be aware of the recent remarks of Dr. Kakodkar, head of the Indian Atomic Energy Commission, who announced plans, very ambitious plans, to import 25 to 28 nuclear reactors from the outside world by the year 2020. You think about the implications of that, both commercially and for the overall thrust of the Indian program. It's rather dramatic, and I would point out to critics of the deal who say that we, haven't captured enough of the Indian civil nuclear program or the overall Indian reactor capacity under IAEA safeguards. That if this were to happen, and I think India has the resources and the disposition to make it happen with the help of France, the United States, Russia, and others, that at that point at least 90% of its overall generating capacity would be captured under safeguard. So you really would have achieved a major shift there in favor of international nonproliferation efforts. Thanks. 25. He said 25 to 28, I believe, by the year 2020, which, and they would all be light water reactors. And they would have to be safeguarded because they would be constructed with outside help.
Sorry. My strong sense is that what the government of India is hoping to do is to basically go along with the U.S. urgent request for Indian help to counter the Iranian nuclear program, but then hope that when the time comes for the pipeline to actually move into a more operational state, which it has not done now, and there's a whole slew of operational problems, not the least of which is the complexity of dealing with the Iranian government to begin with, that they would hope that the U.S. at that point would be willing to stand aside. Whether this is something that they can't have received any assurances on so far, because what the U.S. has said is actually the reverse, but I think that's the hope, and I'm not sure we're going to get much more clarity on that anytime soon. The larger issue is this question of India's independent foreign policy and whether that is a problem from the point of view of either the relationship with the U.S. or, more specifically, the nuclear deal. My view is this is how India behaves in a foreign policy sense. It would be foolhardy for the United States to expect anything else. As some of you know, I am just starting out on what I hope will turn into a book when it grows up about the future of U.S.-India relations. But one of my basic premises is that India and the United States, while they've done a lot to establish the bilateral infrastructure for the relationship, have barely begun, if at all, the task of figuring out how and to what extent our visions of the world coincide. I think this is actually very important. I am very confident that there will not be a complete fit there. our countries are too big, our interests are too diverse. But it seems to me that the thing to look for is not whether India's foreign policy will or will not be, quote-unquote, independent, but where do our interests coincide? And the reason that I've been bullish on U.S.-India relations over the years is that I see the area where we can agree on interests without sweat or strain expanding. And the biggest example over the past 10 years has been Indian Ocean security, which actually used to be a quite contentious issue and has become one of the closest fits between the two governments. Just to vary things, I think I'm going to start at this end of the table and ask Anupam if he'd like to comment. Oh, you thought you had some time.
Well, not too many were directed at me, so I'll just make two quick comments. Ambassador Indefort's point about the non-Luger type of principle to be extended. This is something that India would actually be fairly keen on discussing. Not so much the CTR modeled, but more of talking about the global partnership where India can technologically and through its own experience of diverse locations of its facilities, the heterogeneous workforce and so forth, and how does it track for terrorism and so on. It's a different nuclear security culture approach, if you know, and I know you do know, than what worked in Central Asia, NIS, and in Russia. So India would be quite willing to talk about those kinds of things and where the two can share responsibilities and resources, and also the human and technical intel part of things, because some of what India does on that front from the intelligence point of view actually feeds into these kinds of things. So that would be another. And my last comment would be picking up on this paradigm shift that I was talking about earlier and Raj has talked about. I used to characterize that India would want a seat at the global high table, but would often speak in public like a trade union leader on behalf of NAM and other countries. And so it was difficult for the U.S. to accommodate India at that higher table. The bargaining has changed, the stakes have changed, the Indian position has improved over time, and the government is less in a reactionary mode and more in a pragmatic engagement mode. And that has to be facilitated by an equally reciprocal understanding on the U.S. side, which I think is happening. We are just looking at a process that is unfolding. It might take another year, another two. But I can tell you a number of dialogues between Delhi and Japan, Tokyo and other places that are happening are actually beginning to do this. One last comment to illustrate this is what Kamal Nath managed at the last Doha round of talks when on market subsidies and so on, the U.S. side was stuck in negotiating and the EU was stuck. And he worked throughout the night, actually 1.5 days, to bridge the gap between the G8 position and the G70 position. And the U.S. TR has worked very well after that with India on those things. So in some ways, India is beginning to be a bridge with elements of both developed and developing economy, which in a way relates to what India can do once this partnership is through, both in implementing, but also in the broader strategic global stakeholder partnership that John Hamre was talking about. Thank you.
Very quickly, on Mike's point on criteria, I really, really don't want democracy to be the criteria for nonproliferation benefits, because lots of countries we really worry about aren't democracies. And I think we have to see the effect of the rhetoric, and I think it's a worrisome thing. It can be a criterion, but there's got to be much broader set that are very nuclear specific. Your point on control by cooperation, not denial, is fundamental. Implications way beyond India. Save it for another conversation. On Iran, the premise, I thought, and I think Tazi just spoke to this, was that there is a strategic convergence on key issues. So it seems to me you can't have it both ways, and it's not a question of knuckling under. If it's knuckling under, then the premise was wrong. As we understand it, as I understand it, that this would be in India's self-interest to see Iran not go nuclear, and indeed it's in the stated self-interest of Iran, and very piously intoned and ritualistically so. So I think that's where we should be trying to find the common interest. It's not a question of knuckling under. On the question of fuel cycle and the substantial volumes of uranium that are available, this is a huge question. obviously uranium availability is a function of price and a bunch of other things. It is a true fact, as far as I know, that the U.S. has never been able to demonstrate a plutonium fuel cycle that is at all economically attractive from a sheer business standpoint. Let's keep looking. I think we should not be religious about that subject, but just try to work it. And last point, on the very interesting point you raised, sir, about 25 to 28 reactors being imported, being LWRs, there's no way, even if India started today and put $100 billion on a task, you can't supply the enrichment needs for that fleet of LWRs. Lease the stuff. It's not an abrogation of any right. This is another conversation, but I think there's really a space there to be pursued.
Convergence of strategic interests. I can understand the pressures for Indian support in Iran, but let's look at it in a larger sphere, and that is, I thought the big problem today is the growth of terror, growth of Islamic fundamentalism. Is the requirement for India to support the United States something that the State Department wants, or is it something that America wants? Surely, as far as American interests are concerned, the big issue is perhaps something which goes beyond Indian support to Iran, and that is how it manages 150 million Muslims. The fact that no Indian Muslim has taken part in an international act of terror surely is an extraordinary act of is an extraordinary achievement. And if you consider the fact that 55% of the world's Muslims live in the subcontinent, and if this is a model for the evolution of an Islamic, modern Islamic society, why not leave the Indians to manage what they are doing well? There is a problem not only with the Islamic societies, but the management of sectarian disputes, which our neighboring country hasn't managed to do. And they're basically the same Muslims that exist in India. So what's the difference between the Pakistani Muslim and the Indian Muslim? So maybe it's the Indian State Department or Indian Foreign Office that hasn't leveraged this achievement. But I think you need to look at the fact that this is a much greater task that India is doing in its own self-interest than the requirements that you're asking of India in support to Iran. You might not be aware that the second largest Islamic pilgrimage center is in India, in Ajmer. And the chief mufti of Ajmer has actually come up with a statement asking the Indian government not to vote against Iran. But the fact that India is doing this is shows you what a complex problem it's managing. Surely that's a greater achievement that you're getting from India. Secondly, this fuel cycle. I was asked this question. I'm not a nuclear physicist, but the advantages of the Indian system is that one is that we don't have any uranium, but we have the second largest deposits of thorium. Secondly, the conversion of energy from the light water reactor and the thorium reactor is entirely different. The thorium reactor, if it works, will be much, much more efficient. Thirdly, it will not produce the kind of huge wastes that the light water reactor does. So if it works, there is a great deal going for that system.
Yeah, I think there are a number of questions, and I'll quickly go through some of them. I think on the power expansion, we'd love to lease the fuel. Why do you think we would want to produce it on our own? So the if you're going to build LWRs, the understanding and the current strategy is to get the fuel from outside and please take it back. So that is the basis on which this expansion is going to take place. And this expansion will tilt the program towards a much larger so-called phase one, which is focused on LWRs. And we'll see actually phase two is really necessary, barring a small... I think the DA is so fascinated with itself, so they'll keep running that little breeder program. But whether that will be the logical way to go forward, that history is going to decide, not at this point. Now, on the sequencing and what Shlosha, my friend, was saying was that, look, if you notice, I mean, I think the gains that have been made in the last few years was the administration privately telling India that, look, you do this, it'll be helpful, we'd like to see that, you know, then we can move our side of the game. I mean, I think that's how we've done business in the last year and a half. So I think anything you say, look, if you say adherence a priori helps, because after all, India's position has changed on 1, 2, 3 and the IAEA negotiations. 6 months ago, we were saying we won't talk about this till you show me progress in the Congress. But now we are doing it. So I think these things can be done as long as you don't make it a public question of a demando and India becoming a repondo. Then you take away that and say, look, how do we practically roll this along? And anything, it can be negotiated. And I think we've shown in the last 1 year the kind of things India has done. A defense agreement, nuclear agreement, Iran vote. This is stuff, if anybody had said a Congress government supported by communist parties would do this, you'd have said, get your head examined. So there are a whole lot of things can be done, but the way we do it is more important. On the Cyrus, sir, what you said is actually, you gave the explanation why we had to call it a peaceful nuclear explosion. But the important thing is that we didn't violate any rules. There was an idea called PNE those days. It was part of NPT, Article 5. US and Russia were doing it at that point of the time. I can give you a full legal case. But I think we're going to shut down that reactor. We understand the concerns. We're going to shut down that reactor. And the plutonium that has come out of it is so little relative to the size of the program, I don't think it's of great consequence. Somebody talked about the BJP, as a domestic opposition. Look, I think in all countries, people say and do things. What is interesting is, when I heard about it yesterday, I went and checked back at my Indian papers and television, and nobody even thought it fit to put it on the top news items. Look, for 2 months, Jaswant Singh, Brijesh Mishra, Vajpayee have found every stupid occasion to say something against the deal. But I think that has not made any impact on the business of the columnists. We all make a living out of it. The interesting thing is, why is it not being picked up? Because I think the country has seen a significant substantive debate before 3 months before Bush came. Till he landed, there was an intensive debate. And the atomic energy was involved, public sparring between sections of the government. You had everything was out there, dirty linen being washed in public. And people have seen the debate. They think there's been a reasonable conclusion. And they're waiting to see what happens in the U.S. So whatever the BJP might say, I don't think it's going to make any difference at this stage. Of course, if things go wrong in the Congress, then we are into a different thing. When will India test? Look, as I think Rick pointed out so clearly, look, till the U.S. does something, then China does something, then it's going to be a different world. It doesn't matter at that point whether India's one which followed fifth guy to step in into doing the testing. That world will be a very different world. So we are not going to rock the boat. We're not going to be the first ones to test. And there's no reason for us to do it. There's so much more at stake in the other relationships. There's no way India is going to start the chain. And most probably it'll start somewhere in Livermore or wherever, Los Alamos or here. The dynamic here might change. Then we're into a different world. That world is going to be a completely different set of conditions are going to operate. On the three important issues. On NPT, no one in India is saying tear up the treaty. Please keep it. We have no problem. We've endorsed it in 2000. We've endorsed it in 2005. We will do everything as long as we work together. We can keep supporting it. As long as you tell me that my being non-signatory to the NPT will complicate cooperation with me, you take care of that. We have no problem with the NPT. We're willing to support any initiative. As long as you take care of that problem, as non-signatory, I'm not going to be penalized in any area. Now, this brings me to the question of Iran. Now, the pipeline, look, I think we thought we were doing a big favor to the Americans. Because for years they told us, be nice to Pakistan, do CBMs with Pakistan, Musharraf wants the pipeline, please, here is a laundry list we gave you, every year we give you one laundry list of CBMs, please go ahead and do this with Pakistan, do economic diplomacy, do CBMs. Now, when Manmohan Singh did it in September 2004, he was doing it as a favor for Musharraf. Iran was far from his mind. Because he was meeting Musharraf for the first time, he thought he's a man he could do business with and say, look, how do I be nice to Musharraf? That was the context in which that announcement was made. Now, then the Americans descend on us saying that how dare you do CBMs with Pakistan? This is just not acceptable to us. And if you saw the Prime Minister's interview after July 18th, then there's an interview to Washington Post. The day we got a nuclear deal, we said very clearly, the Prime Minister's interview says, look, there's going to be a financing problem, there is going to be technical evaluation. Do you want even anything more naked than that to tell you the Prime Minister, the day after signing the nuclear deal, says, look, we're going to go slow on the Iran deal. But don't ask us to stop negotiating with Iran. This is going to be negotiated. This is going to be a big tease. Iranians are great at it. We are not bad at it. So we're going to keep talking. Now, if that offends a lot of people, I don't see, I mean, then we can't, you know, you can, paranoid can't be appeased. So, look, this pipeline is not going to work till U.S.-Iran relations improve, period. So, there is no way of this pipeline is going to go forward. I've been a strong supporter of this for Indo-Pak reasons. We want to integrate with Pakistan. That's a different set of issues. On the last set of, on the question of Muslims, look, I don't think India is going to accept Muslims define our policy to Muslim world, and you have Shias defining policy to Iran, or Tamils deciding policy to Sri Lanka. That's not acceptable. But like in all democratic societies, sure, the Florida has some impact on U.S.-Cuban policy. I mean, that is democratic politics. You can't take that away. But you can't have our policy to each country being defined by our ethnic composition. No, that's never going to be acceptable. But the real question with Iran is, I mean, we've kept quiet when Russians were in Afghanistan. Muslims were upset. So what? Russians were friends. So if the Americans are going to, tomorrow you're going to send in your troops, please do, we'll hold our nose and support you. But so you know, don't make it a permanent question of proving, you know, that every day we have to stand up and say Iran is a bad guy. When your own policy is evolved, you are negotiating now, you're going to negotiate with them, hopefully. And so therefore, we understand our interests. We have no desire to come and conflict with your interest in Iran. It, how you handle it is your business. But leave some space so that we have some dignity in doing this, and don't make it appear that every day we have to stand up and say, oh, we are with Americans and Iran. There's no need to do that. As long as we understand each other, what we're doing, there is no need for this public affirmation. The last question on independent foreign policy. Look, I don't think India is going to abandon independent foreign policy. I mean, and as Ambassador Clark said, look, it's U.S., India, China are going to set the tone for a lot of things. The question is, do we cooperate? What are the lines on which we cooperate? I think that's fairly clear. And more important is that India is never going to be a Britain to the United States. We're not going to be a Japan to the United States. And as Ambassador Clark said, look, India can be out there doing a lot of things with the U.S., but don't expect a subordinate, subsidiary partner. And those partners, really beyond a point, are of no great help. And I think what U.S. needs is a strong partner, and I think India will be a strong partner in the future. Thank you.
Well, I have one responsibility left, and that is to thank you all very much, and particularly to thank our panelists for a discussion that I think has put a lot of new material on the table at a time when I hope we will be able to do something with it. So thanks first to all our panelists. And thanks to all of you for making this a real discussion.